Welcome back to the program. Edmund Burke once wrote that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. But what happens when good men do take action, and the net result of their efforts is to in some way fuel the evil, and worst of all, be impacted by it in ways that taint their own goodness? In many ways, history is filled with such examples. Certainly the history of the Middle East over the past 10 years is a classic example. And this is the framework that my guest, Nadeem Islam, has looked at in his new novel, The Blind Man's Garden. Nadeem Islam is the author of 3 highly acclaimed novels, including Season of the Rainbirds. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to the program today to talk about The Blind Man's Garden. Nadeem Islam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Delight to have you here. In your view, have the past 10 years in that part of the world, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, been more tumultuous, been more problematic than previous periods?
Well, the first line of the book is, history is the third parent. So, I mean, in some parts of the world, history is always present, and it is in the room with you. In my previous novel, The Wasted Vigil, I wrote a sentence that the Cold War was cold only for the privileged races of the planet. So, you know, there was the policies of the Cold War. We can view them as that they guaranteed and they brought into being about 40 years of peace. But that was only for, as I said, for the Western countries. All the blood was spilled over there in the Third World. Right. You know, so basically next door to Pakistan and within Pakistan. I'm talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979. And it was decided that by the CIA, that with the help of the Saudi Arabian regime, millions of dollars of funds and weapons will be poured into Afghanistan via Pakistan. And and that was within my lifetime. I mean, I was a teenager then. So I remember whatever Pakistan might have been like before 1979, I actually remember how it changed within a year of my lifetime, in that the dictator, who then had the backing of the entire world, entire Western world, because he was somehow this plucky freedom fighter who was helping to defeat the Soviets. What he did at home was not known to anyone, you know, that he brought into being this the jihadi policies. And there were people back then who were saying, don't do this. What is going to happen to these beautiful shiny weapons once the Soviets leave? And of course the Soviets left in 1989 and the civil war started immediately. But of course the West turned its gaze away from it, because now the Soviets had been defeated and the Soviets had been given their Vietnam, as it were. They had been given a bloody nose, and all the mess was there in was there for the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan to deal with. And that situation festered and festered for another decade. And then in 2001, the attacks in New York and Washington happened. And then half the world reacted as though it had come out of the blue, as though it was an apolitical, ahistorical act, as though it did not have its roots in the policies of these countries over the past 30 or 40 years. So, as I said, in some unfortunate places of the planet, history is always there.
One of the things you talk about is that much of what has happened over the past 10 years in particular that you focus on is because of a lack of understanding on the part of the West and a lack of understanding on the part of the East about each other. In many ways, it can also be said that it's also a lack of understanding in both places about their own history and their own cycles of history.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's a very beautiful way of putting it. But to go back to earlier, to your point a moment earlier, that me saying that there a clash has occurred in between an incomplete understanding of the East and an incomplete understanding of the West. On the second page of the novel, you'll find this sentence The logic is that there are no innocent people in a guilty nation. And that sentence is spoken or thought in the context of the attacks on the Twin Towers. In that, so it's not that the West refuses to see the humanity of the people in the Muslim world, as it were, but the certain forces within the Muslim world are also adamant that they will not see any humanity in the people who live within Western countries. So if the policies of the American government are something that you disagree with, that means that the entire population of America is, as it were, fair game. And of course, that comes out of my very deep conviction that I don't understand anything about boundaries and frontiers, especially as a human being and also as an artist. When I sit down, you know, I always say that I could live anywhere if I loved someone. So what America? What England? What Germany or Afghanistan? So that is the starting point, always.
And in many ways, it is the starting point for these two foster brothers that are at the center of this story in The Blind Man's Garden.
Absolutely. And one of the key things to remember about these two brothers who go off to Afghanistan in October 2001, one of them is a medical student, and they want to go and help the wounded civilians because the NATO bombing has started. That this was not me trying to dodge the issue, as it were. This is not me saying that, oh, these two boys are innocent, that they were caught in the war. And we actually begin with these two brothers, but eventually in the novel, I actually show you the characters who say, no, I want to go to Afghanistan to fight the American soldiers. So we actually explore those as well, because there can be this attitude that, oh God, everybody at Guantanamo Bay is saying that they were innocent, that they were attending a wedding in Afghanistan when they were picked up. I am as interested in the innocence as I am by the jihadi mindset. I now live part of the time in Pakistan, and I go and talk to these chaps who are in the training camps or who are becoming radicalized or who are in the process of becoming radicalized, and you go and talk to them and think, what is the reasoning behind it? And the reasons that they give up, you know, they have those reasons that I'm going to base these actions in the teachings of the Quran. That one of the most humiliating things as a writer over the past decade has been this corruption of language that has occurred. So the American regime tells us about this thing called extraordinary rendition. What they mean is torture or kidnapping. You know, I want them to say these words. Not try to fuzzy them and not try to use alternatives. And the same thing has happened. Once again, I have a responsibility both to the East and the West, because I am from the East, but I live in the West. So it is happening over there with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who have reduced this word called jihad to its one meaning, which is just fighting and war, as it were. But the word jihad has as many meanings as a rose has petals. To smile at someone when you don't feel like smiling is jihad. To be kind to someone when your own life is full of meanness is jihad. So that was one of the things I wanted to explore. So in a way, everyone in the novel, even those who are not in the battlefield, are engaged in jihad, as it were, because people always say to me, your books tend to be rather melancholy and sad and perhaps even tragic or bleak. Where is the hope? And I always say that the hope is the characters, the struggle of the characters, that they are thrown into these really intense situations and How do they come out of it? Within that intense situation, how does character A and character B behave? And the hero and heroine in the novel, and even some of the older people in the novel, they are constantly trying to say, this is a bad situation, but I must try to behave with honor and dignity within this. Sometimes they fail, and then they regret that, but that regret also is valid.
Part of it is, though, that these two brothers, for example, start out, as you talk about, on no one's side, really. They're looking for justice in many ways. They're looking to do the right thing. But the minute they do anything, the minute they do what they perceive to be the right thing, they somehow become tainted. They somehow become caught up in what's going on. And it's very hard to be innocent once that happens.
Absolutely. But that's the nature of the times we live in. And that perhaps has always been the case. I like to explore politics in my literature. Now, there are any number of writers who say that politics has no place in literature, and certainly not in fiction. But I think that what they mean is that their description of politics is a narrow one. Dostoevsky dealt with politics, Orwell did, Garcia Marquez did, Conrad did, Milosh did, J.M. Coetzee, Emile Zola, Nadine Gordimer. How far do you want to go back? You know, and people are always responding to the times and looking at it and saying, what are the complexities within this, these 10 years we've lived through, or these 15 years we've lived through? I mean, political horror is there at the center of the New Testament. What is the story of Christ, of the death of Christ, if looked at through secular eyes, if not about the political corruptions and compromises within a government and within a system? You can, if you leave God out of it. It can be used. And the English novel, in a way, it can be argued that, I mean, beginning with Dickens and Trollope and Hardy, was always a social protest movement, in a way, that people looked at the society around them. Dickens wrote about child labor. Trollope wrote about the stigma of illegitimacy. Hardy wrote about classical exclusion and gender exclusion. And I happen to be alive in a time when the war on terror seems to be happening. And there is Guantanamo Bay, and there is Abu Ghraib, and there is Malala Yousafzai being shot in the head by the Taliban. So all of these things. And as a novelist, I feel a responsibility to explore what happens to the innocents when they are caught up. And I have to say that I keep being told all the time that your books are very tragic. And which is fine. I work in that register. There are any number of people who write comic novels. I am not one of them. I happen to work in a really intense mode and try to see how does a character behave within an intense situation. And the idea of a happy ending or a sad ending again comes up again and again in my novels, in interviews and reviews. But I think that to have gained knowledge of how things went wrong in the lives of the characters and why things go wrong in our own lives by extension, I think that is a happy ending. So, you know, and I think that is what happened at the end of my novel.
I don't know that it's a question of happy endings or sad endings. It's how we hold on to our humanity in the face of the brutality that exists in the world.
Exactly, and to triumph inwardly while you are under stress, and you might be destroyed by the outward situation, but to actually inwardly, not to let your soul be corrupted, not to let your conscience be corrupted. And we're all human. If you fail, then the consequences of that, meaning guilt, meaning how do I seek forgiveness, etc., etc., that is the important thing for me.
Talk a little bit about, in the context of this story, the role played by the kind of love story that's at the center of it, too, in this search for this woman.
Absolutely, yes. Well, my early reading life was steeped in classical Urdu, Persian, and perhaps even Arabic literature, if we count the Quran as a book of poetry. And and in Islamic literature, the quest for the beloved is a very important motif. It's so a man searching for the woman he loves, or a woman searching for the man she loves, is actually another way of saying the soul is searching for God. That comes directly out of Islamic literature, and I'm perfectly aware that it is there in my books, that love tends to be an elemental force in my books. So we have in the novel the hero and heroine, Mikal, who's a 20-year-old young man, and Nahid, who is a 19-year-old young woman. And they are in love, and they are apart. Mikal ends up when he goes to Afghanistan, he ends up the prisoner of a warlord. And then he's sold, basically, to American soldiers as a terrorist, who proceed to interrogate him. As we know, that such sites exist, so-called black sites. They exist where prisoners are interrogated, quote unquote, and eventually he finds his way back towards Nahid, and the book charts his journey towards Nahid, and they meet three quarters of the way through the book, and in that chapter, Nahid utters what for me is the key sentence of the novel. She says, "I haven't seen you for 379 days, and I feel as though I have been in 479 days, I feel as though I have been in 479 wars." And that, for me, was a way of connecting what the women go through during war, even though they stay at home, and it's the men who are out there with the daggers and the bullets, what have you, but the women, how they have to cope with what happens to a society within war. That is important. And the second important thing, again, it is there when they meet. And it was really my way of articulating my own sorrow about the things. And so Mikal asks her, "Do you blame your husband for going to Afghanistan?" And she says, "Yes, I'm angry at him for going to Afghanistan and going there without telling us. And I'm angry at you for not informing us of his intentions. I'm angry at myself for not having detected them. I'm angry at America for invading Afghanistan. I'm angry at the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for doing what they did to the Twin Towers." I said, "What does it matter?" And then he says, "It matters." And she asks him, "Does it?" And he very emphatically says, "Yes, it does." So that was my way of saying that we are surrounded by these very giant forces in which we really have no say. But we small human beings, what we feel and what we go through does matter. It might not matter on a large scale, but it matters on a day-to-day basis. And how one person touches another. And when I was working on the book took 4.5 years to write. And in about the second year of the novel, of the writing of it, I had a moment of crisis. I said to myself, why the plot of the book seems to be that Mikal is journeying towards Nahid, and Nahid is at home waiting for him. And what exactly is going to change when they meet? three quarters of the way through the novel, the war on terror is not going to end. He has been tortured. That he's not going to be untortured. His brother is dead. He's not going to come back. What exactly is going to happen once they meet? And of course, now he asked that question of Nahid, that we are together, what now? And she says that the difficult things are not going to go away, but we will face them together. That is why you and me and being here is important. And that is what I learned in the second year of a novel. And that is, in a way, was what Nahid told me, my own character. Sometimes my characters are wiser than I am. That the collective knowledge of the book, which is the collective knowledge of a society speaking through me, is greater than my own small experiences.
Did you have concerns during 4.5 years of working on this that events in the region, events in the world, would spin out of control in ways that changed the landscape of what you were writing about?
That's a very good question. And I think it is related to my answer, to the answer to the previous question, mm-hmm. that I'm talking about certain elemental things. In that, that the way two people love each other is not going to change. I know the political landscape might change, but the way two people relate to each other, that is not going to change. And once again, I will repeat that if you look at the first chapter of the novel, of The Blind Man's Garden, it's a very small chapter and it is one page long. And the first sentence, as I said earlier, is history is the third parent. But by the time we get to the bottom of the page, which is that a child is frightened by the story that his father is telling him, and the father says, no need to be worry because the bad guys never win in any story. Have I ever told you a story in which the villain actually wins? And he says, no, I know that they will lose eventually, but I'm frightened of what they will do before they are defeated. We begin with a big historical force at the top of the page. The first word of the novel is history. But by the bottom of the page, by the end of that chapter, we are in a human, touchable, recognizably human place. Because, okay, so let's say that the Taliban are defeated in 10 years' time, 15 years' time. Let's say that the drone attacks stop in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, and there is worldwide peace. Okay. What if the Taliban, while they are in power, meaning now, they kill my brother? So in 10 years' time, they're gone. But my brother is still dead. How do I cope with this loss? Even though the world has sorted itself out, how do I live with the fact that there is a howling absence next to me? And that, I think, is what is the job of a novelist. It's certainly what is a novelist like me, that we begin with a political backdrop, but we then home in on the small things, you and me and you and with each of our listeners on a day-to-day basis. Those connections. And as I said earlier, how do I make amends for a mistake I've made? How do I get over grief? I mean, sometimes it seems to me that I've never got over a single thing in my entire life. You know, time heals nothing. But we are allocated these 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years on this planet, and we have to, you know, frequently on our own or one or two people around us have to negotiate a way through it and to tell the bigger forces that, look, I do matter. And I think that is what art can do. It can show the big forces that even though we are small, that we do matter, as Mikal reassures Nahid. Yes, what you feel matters.
Nadeem Islam, the book is The Blind Man's Garden. It's just out from Knopf. Nadeem, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.